Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 5th, 2003. Today's session is a forum on Iraq Today with Jonathan Frericks from Lutheran World Relief presenting, number FRJ 2003-01. Let's listen in.
This Tuesday night forum. If I haven't met you already, my name is Diane and Janet Grant, this is the village's co-director. And you probably saw on kiosk that the title for tonight's forum said an eyewitness view of post-war Iraq. And it really should have said eyewitness views of post-war Iraq. We are really very, very fortunate that we have two people here in community who have both been in Iraq within about the last 4 months, maybe three, maybe five, but about that amount of time, and have been involved in the delivery of humanitarian aid in Iraq, but with very different viewpoints. We're really happy, and by the way, both people, Jim Wilkerson here is here as a guest, part of a big family reunion, and Jim is a flight instructor for the Boeing company, but also in the Air Force Reserve. And so he went on active duty last March, April, and May to fly C-17s, which I just got a little education about, and you're going to see in some of his slides, as part of the mission in both Afghanistan and in Iraq. And so we are really happy that he is able to be with us. And then Jonathan Frericks is actually a carpenter on our staff for a couple weeks, short-term volunteer. But in his outside hat, he is the communications director for Lutheran World Relief. And this has carried him to many, many parts of the world. He's been on teaching staff before. But it also brought him to Iraq within the last 4 months, partially around some of the negotiations and the difficulties of the NGOs or some of the international nonprofits providing humanitarian aid in Iraq. I am really, really, really pleased that we can have both of them here tonight presenting. Occasionally, we get an evaluation that says that Holden has only one point of view. And so for me, it is really exciting that we can look at a shared concern that we all have with some different eyes, and hopefully that will give us a little bigger picture, maybe a little more complicated, something more to think about, but that's exactly the purpose of a forum. I do want to say that this is not going to be a debate on whether or not we should have gone to war. Both of these men have been involved in here we are. We did go to war. This is where we are right now. They both have been involved in activity there, and so we're taking that as the starting point. It is not intended at all even to be a debate, but to sort of broaden our ideas, to become more educated, to ask some questions, and to simply learn more about what really is a huge issue in terms of the rebuilding a country whose infrastructure was absolutely in decay even before the events of this last year, but now it is quite devastated. And so we bring our concerns, questions, and respect and honoring that we would like to foster, as we may have some differences in the room. But I hope that this can become a model for the way forums ought to be upholding. A learning experience for everyone with a lot of respect for different points of view. That way we learn a lot more. So with that being said, I'm not going to have a whole lot to say. We're going to let Jim start first with some of his slides and some of his experience. And I think we want to talk about later. And let's welcome him. This is really great.
We're pleased to be able to be part of this presentation tonight. I'd like to especially thank Diane and Jonathan for welcoming me in to the presentation. It's kind of a last-minute addition. I'd also like to thank Don Eisenstein for helping me sort through my slides today and pick out some ones we thought would be of interest. My name is Jim Wilkerson. I've been a member of Pilgrim Lutheran Church in Puyallup, Washington for 2 years. And the two series of slides you're going to see tonight are going to cover two 15-day missions that I field with the reserves, leaving Adam Accord and staging either out of Germany or Doha in Qatar and flying into Afghanistan, Iraq, and various other places. In fact, I went to Czechoslovakia, we went into Djibouti one day, into Kuwait, in a total of about 9 or 10 countries over the 4 weeks that we were there.
Can you speak up a little, please?
Yes, I will. Thank you. The first slide here is we flew out of Accord on March 18th, and this is the sun coming up on March 19th, going into Germany. This is somewhere out over the Atlantic just before we coasted in over England. Next slide. This is approximately the same view. This is the co-pilot taxiing the airplane into parking in Germany. Next slide. This is a picture of myself and one of the aircraft's loadmasters. The C-17 has a minimum crew of 2 pilots and 1 loadmaster. That lets us operate the airplane for about 16 hours out of a day. We add 2 more crew members, a pilot and a loadmaster, for a total of 5 people. We can operate the airplane over a 24-hour cycle. There's berthing facilities on the airplane that allows us to have a crew member in the various positions resting while the other ones are working. The loadmaster's job in the airplane, the pilot's job, is pretty self-explanatory. The loadmaster's job is to supervise the ground crew loading and unloading cargo from to and from the aircraft. And they also take the weights of the cargo and balance it through the airplane. The airplane has a fairly limited, what's called a center of gravity, where if we have too much heavy cargo in the nose or the tail, the airplane doesn't fly quite right. So a lot of technical expertise involved in their jobs. Next slide. This is the airplane on the ramp at Ramstein, Germany. This is the evening of March 19th. For those of you who may not remember, that's the day that hostilities began. We had a load of ammunition we're taking into Kuwait City at that time. Next slide. This is me again. That's a pallet of mortar and small arms ammunition that I'm sitting on. We had 7 or 8 of these, plus the MREs that you hear a lot about, the prepackaged foods for the troops. Next slide. This is the next day, March 20th. We're on the ground in Kuwait City at the airport. We were there in a time frame, fortunate for us, that there were no Scud attacks. However, there were 4 or 5 Scud alarms during the day, during that day, March 20th. Next slide. Besides the military airlift, the services were also using contract carriers. World Airways, their DC-10, they're bringing in cargo, just like we were. Also in the background, some Army Chinook helicopters. Interesting to note, the hedge that you see in the foreground, just behind that, there was a 6-foot deep by 3-foot wide concrete trench. And when the scud alarms went, everybody ran and jumped in the trench. We waited until the scud alarm was over. Then everyone, of course, was putting the gas masks on and such. When the all clear was called, everybody climbed back out of the trench and went back to their jobs. Next slide. This is in Germany. Two of the other folks on our crew and some of the bags that we carry, not just our clothing, like you bring up here to hold it, we also had 2 separate chemical warfare bags, plus our what we call a camping gear. We had a sleeping bag, a mess kit, if we were deployed to an austere location. So we actually had a 7-person crew, so you can imagine it's quite a pile of bags that we were hauling around with us from place to place. Next slide. Another picture of me, I'm wearing my flight helmet, and what you see in front of my eyes is called a night vision goggle device. We would often fly into these locations at night with very few lights in the airplane and deprive folks that were possibly looking to do us harm the opportunity to see us. The goggles themselves amplify available light. Some of you may have seen something similar to this in hunting magazines or such, but it picks up infrared sources as well. It essentially turns night into day, and any kind of light at all, starlight or very little moonlight, it really is kind of amazing technology. And we'll see some pictures a little later, actually through the night vision devices themselves. Next slide. This is the airfield at Bagram in Afghanistan. While we were there, there was a lot of troop movements. There were units that were there were leaving, and other units were coming in to replace them. So we actually flew 4 or 5 missions in Afghanistan itself. You're looking at an Army Apache helicopter sitting there on the ramp and some Army vehicles, service vehicles in the background. And the airfield itself has a large, has, like here in Holden, there's a lot of high level terrain, a lot of mountains around, so it's a fairly exciting approach in there, making sure that you clear the terrain as you approach the airfield. Next slide. This is a pile of abandoned Soviet equipment at one end of the runway. Somebody at one point got a bulldozer and just said, we'll just get all this stuff together in one pile. Some old MiG-21 fighter planes and Antonov transport planes there. Next slide. This is the actual airfield at Bagram itself. And during the conflict over there, at one point, the line ran somewhere like this through the airfield itself with our forces on one side and the Al-Qaeda forces on the other. So as you can imagine, there's a lot of wrecked vehicles and bomb craters and such around the airfield. It really is quite an interesting experience going in there. What you see here lined up are more of the Army helicopters. And this is a C-17 that arrived just before we left. And that's approximately where we were parked in the airfield. And the Army would bring K-loaders and such and unload the airplane. Next slide. Very exciting mission we flew on our first trip was we went into one of the airfields in northern Iraq called Peshawar. This was on the night of March 31st, early morning of April 1st. This is a cargo of ammunition and rations for the crew. Northern Iraq is one of the airfields in the Kurdish-controlled areas where the special forces teams went in and opened up the airfield. We went in completely blacked out, all our defensive systems armed. A lot of other air traffic. The bombing was still going on in Baghdad, so we could see a lot of the flashes in the horizons. We were flying south, and other assets out there duking it out with anti-aircraft artillery on the ground, so we saw a lot of ground-to-air and air-to-ground tracers going off that night. Really, at this point, because the air defenses have been degraded, the biggest danger we really faced was hitting another one of our airplanes. And again, fortunately, with the night vision goggles, all the other airplanes out there were magnified, so you had a really good idea of where all the traffic was around you. Next slide. It's another picture in the back of the airplane. One of our loadmaster on the left, and one of the airplane crew chiefs on the right. Next slide. Fast forward a month until the second week in April, our second trip out. This is a C-17 on the ramp at Charleston Air Force Base in South Carolina, and the moon coming up over the tail. Next slide. We spent about 2 weeks at Doha International Airport in the country of Qatar, and if you remember the briefings that were given on a daily basis from Central Command, that's where most of these briefings took place, was in this country. There's some C-130s on the ramp, and we shared the airport with civilian traffic. We had our own area inside. Next slide. It's a picture of thunderstorms one night when we flew into Kuwait. Next slide. This is the airplane's navigational display, and we have the radar up, and this is what a thunderstorm looks like to aircraft radar. What the radar does is it tracks the precipitation in the thunderstorm itself, the rain shaft. And with the green areas being very light precipitation going all the way into dark red and pink for very heavy areas of precipitation. And that's how airplanes stay out of thunderstorms. They see where the worst precipitation is, that's the center of the thunderstorm, we can fly around it. Next slide. First mission into Iraq. The machine here is called a K-loader, and it's basically a pallet with wheels on it. You can see some of the rollers here. The bottom floor, the cargo floor of the airplane has rollers on it, and our cargo pallets are basically 6 foot by 6 foot squares of aluminum. You pile boxes on that, throw a cargo net off the top of it. It's very easy to roll those in and roll those off the airplane. It makes the loading and unloading of cargo much more efficient. These machines, they needed them in Iraq to take the cargo off that we were bringing in, so that was some of the first cargoes that were taken in there. Next slide. It's the airplane, one of the airplanes we flew on the ramp at Al Udeid, which is another air base in Qatar. Next slide. This is the flight deck of the airplane. With the pilot and the co-pilot seats up front, and then two observer seats left, or right, left, aft. And then there's the back wall, there's a crew rest compartment, and then stairs down into the cargo bay. Next slide. This is a picture, as I promised earlier, through the night vision device. This is a night mission into Bagram in Afghanistan. These are the lights of the city, the built-up areas that are around the city of Bagram. And you can just see a set of dim parallel lights here just south of the city. Those are the infrared runway lights. We can fly in with the night vision devices. You can't see these lights without the naked eye. They're in the infrared. But we can pick them up with the night vision devices. It allows us to find the airfield and land in almost complete darkness. Next slide. This is one of the taxiways at Bagram. This large splotch here is the bright landing light that we have. They put a cover over the light so it emits only in the infrared, but it's still putting an awful lot of light out. Next slide. There's a piece of equipment there on the airfield at Bagram. Next slide. This is another one of our loadmasters. He's marshaling the equipment back out of the airplane. The ramp goes down, the back doors open up, and the drivers sit in the trucks, and the loadmaster, just like he's back in the truck into a loading dock, uses hand signals to marshal the equipment off the aircraft. Next slide. One of the Army's Humvees. Next slide. Gave you an idea of the size of the cargo we can carry. This is an 18-wheel trailer truck that's just driven off the back of the airplane. Next slide. So, Canadian Air Force exchange officer that flew with us on one of our missions. Next slide. This is the ramp at, another picture of the ramp at Doha, and some of the large collapsible tents that were used to store the equipment. And we lived in trailers that were located back behind these. Next slide. Our second and third missions into Iraq had really shifted more towards humanitarian aid. We have, there's 6x6 aluminum pallets I mentioned earlier. The airplane can carry 14 of those. The grate's about 6 feet tall, so stacked to a height of 6 feet. And the airplane was completely loaded with surgical equipment, baby diapers, and formula. So this was probably the 26th or 27th of April. So the military was really starting to bring in a lot of stuff to help support the civilian population. Next slide. It's one of the forklifts they use. They back that, an alternate method for unloading the airplane. They back those tines up. These rollers here were raised. You just slide the pallet over that. They lift the tines of the forklift up and haul the pallets off the back of the airplane. Next slide. Another picture of me. This is out the back of the airplane. This is a lot of the cargo that we brought in stacked up waiting for distribution. We were wearing flak vests and helmets on the way in, and it felt a little silly at one point because you get there and then the guys unloading the airplane are all running around in t-shirts. Next slide. We had taken some Air Force people out that had been in there for quite a while. One of them had this Saddam International Airport sign, so we borrowed that from her and took some crew pictures out on the ramp. This is actually the ramp at Baghdad International Airport, the terminal buildings that you see behind us. Next slide.
Was it hot there?
It was probably in the 80s to low 90s, but this was April, so it was still spring. And I've heard tell that it's up to the 120s or 130s this time of year. Also brought some American flags with us. And again, you can see we're wearing our flag vests.
Hey, Jim, yes. You mentioned this guy on the left.
Oh, the guy on the left, his name's Dana Whitfield. He works as a hospital administrator, I think in San Jose, but I wouldn't swear to it. But over July 4th, he'd taken this picture back. I'd burned a CD of all the pictures I took for each of the crew members. And during the July 4th celebrations, they printed up like a 3-foot by 5-foot picture of this and put it out in the hospital, just kind of showing the people there that, you know, what part some of the hospital people were playing in the conflict. Next slide. More terminal buildings. This is some of the wreckage from the fighting. That's, I think, the remains of a Jeep. Next slide. This is a Russian-built T-72 tank from the Republican Guard. The tank was blown up with such force that the turret actually came off the top and is laying behind the rest of the chassis of the tank there in the dirt. And again, some more of the buildings from the airport in the background. Next slide. This is a shot of the main tower at Baghdad International Airport. And sort of fix this in your mind. For the next slide is going to be essentially the same scene, but under night vision illumination. We did this one daylight flight, and then later that day we flew them at night. Next slide. That's kind of the same scene, and you can see the terminal building here. Next slide. This is just a gee whiz picture. This is what one of the aircraft engines looks like, basically in the infrared. And the kind of the white glowing parts of the engine are the hot parts. See, this slide sleeve has been slid back. The engines are in reverse, so the thrust of the engine is actually being directed up. When we flew in to these locations, we'd not even shut the engines down. So in case the airfield was attacked while we were there, we just pulled the engines out of reverse and leave, close the doors and leave. So every mission that we flew into Iraq, we never even shut the engines down. Next slide. That's it. Be happy to answer questions after Jonathan's done with this session.
After the fall of Baghdad, and I got there on land in a fleet of GMC Suburbans, which make great desert ships, about 9 of them, and we bounced our way to the Jordanian-Iraqi border from Amman, Jordan, about a 12-hour drive, about 1,000 kilometers. And then when we hit Iraq, the freeways got twice as good. They really knew how to build freeways with the oil money. And there was no traffic, and certainly no highway patrolmen. And so picture 9 GMC Suburbans, you know, which you can fit 8 people in comfortably, on cruise control at 100 miles an hour, about a vehicle length apart from each other, sort of playing tag on this empty freeway. And we got there, and what struck me first was just to look at this country, you know, which I'm going to try to stay focused here, but, you know, where was civilization invented? Where does the oldest civilization history come from? What all has happened there? You know, the Chaldeans, all this stuff, Assyrian. But what I first really started to notice, besides the Tigris and Euphrates, was that the guardrails look like there have been a lot of accidents on this freeway. But it was weird because the people having the accidents managed to spin out in a straight line across all 4 sets of guardrails. And it took me a while, but then I figured out those are where the tanks crossed. As the tanks circled Baghdad, and I don't know whose tanks did what, but the tanks just went right across the guardrails, and you can take it from me that tanks are stronger than guardrails. So I got there, and I stayed in a little hotel where the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations, and some of the other people were staying, in the same perimeter as the Palestine Hotel, where all the media was coming from. You know, where the statue was toppled in the circle, independent circle, or whatever it's called. That's right in front of the Palestine Hotel. There were 30 TV networks on the roof of that, of the lower level, all pointed at that circle and all doing stand-ups at certain times of the day. It was like a bunch of cows feeding in the wall, you know. And I went up to the top. They let me in even though I was staying there. I went to the top, about 28 stories, and crept out on the roof. I just sat there in this sort of sandstorm atmosphere that you saw in Kip's pictures. There was a couple of those real sandy days. And just looked out at this city and thought again about, you know, 4,000 years of civilization, and all the stuff that's happened in our lifetime there, and just had this you know, real kind of, wow, what a place. And it struck me, I was looking at a landscape of folly, and a landscape of anticipation, and a landscape of fear. The folly is there for you to see. Saddam Hussein, like any dictator who has money, had some really crazy projects going on. On the horizon was a mosque that is only going to be finished in 2015. I don't know if you picked it up, but it had spires the size of the tallest space needle you could, like Seattle Space Needle would hardly be visible beside this thing. Huge dome, many spires around it. It was going to be finished in 2015, a mosque. Other buildings like that, ministries punctured by the very precise weaponry, so collapsed ministries, broken ministries, everything official associated with that regime seemed to have been taken out or been abandoned as the regime had crumbled. And then, of course, monuments to Saddam, and you've seen the picture of the two sabers crossed across that highway, things like that. It reminded me of the East Bloc countries in the communist time. It was a lot like, or today if you go to North Korea, lots of monuments to yourself as the leader of that country. So there was the folly. Remember that poem Ozymandias that you had to study in high school? Anybody remember Ozymandias? Mm-hmm. Well, that was not a good suggestion. It's about a poem about a great statue fallen dead in the desert, and how great it was and how nothing it is now. That's what I felt looking up. Anticipation of liberation, a landscape of anticipation of why? Liberation, getting rid of that guy. And everybody I met said, thank you for getting rid of Saddam. Nobody said anything different. Anticipation of democracy. And some people who were a little slow thought that democracy meant no traffic laws and you can loot. So a sort of a wild sense of anarchy. And then the third sort of landscape that I felt around in the days I was there was the sort of landscape of fear. Definite fear of the chaos. You know how most of us obey the law and therefore society is orderly? Well, most Iraqis were doing that too. But the 1% or the 2% or the 0.5% who didn't choose to obey the law were busy stealing, looting, going into the ministries, killing people. It felt like a 4th of July every night with firearms being shot off, sometimes just in the air, sometimes in feuds between rival groups. One meeting I went to, a German man came in shaking, and he had just seen a person pulled over out of a car and stood up in the street and shot. In a targeted killing, 4 blocks from where we were meeting, and that was broad daylight. So a real sense of fear. Fear also of the U.S.'s intentions. People who have been oppressed by a dictator, the last thing they want is to be oppressed again. And they really feel that strongly. And Iraq is a very educated, very repressed place under Saddam, and they're eager to take care of their own affairs. And then fear of Saddam's return. Quite a few people said, don't count him out. This guy has 9 lives. We've seen him. So that was sort of a landscape that I felt like was around me as you sit on top of this hotel. And what I'd like to do is explain what I was doing there by keeping you on top of that hotel and inviting you to try to get your bearings in that kind of a landscape and get your bearings in a sense by following through and seeing some examples of what Lutheran World Relief and some of its partner agencies were involved in. Two ways for us, or three ways really, to get your bearings. It's sort of like, I think it's important to say, in a place that is under that much conflict, and our work takes us to conflicted areas, complex emergencies all the time, you have to really ask yourself, who is not being heard? What is not being said? Who aren't we learning anything about? What's missing from this picture? What explains this picture? So I think that's the start of getting your bearings in this amazing city as you look up. 5 million people, by the way, stretch as far as the horizon in all directions, just in the city of Baghdad. And then two other things help, I think, get our bearings. One is we've been working with churches of the Middle East for decades, 30, 40, 50 years, and in Iraq through the terrible decade of the 90s between the two Gulf Wars, helping through those churches to meet some very basic needs in Iraq. And so I think that's an important way to start finding some solid ground to stand on. And I think of it this way because there was a palpable sense in Iraq of everything being in flux. You know, when you tried to drive, you couldn't drive because there was no traffic laws. And the streets were absolutely jammed. And it was sort of like people fighting who gets to go. And the cars are all 30 years old. Dictatorships have old cars that have been patched 19 times. Didn't stop it. You can get a taxi, you can flag down any car you got there, and they'll give you a ride. And you turn, the one guy who was driving, he turned the wheel, and the whole front end would go, you pay this guy, and he's going to get your car. But this sense of anything could happen. Your car's front wheels could fall off. Somebody could shoot you. One morning, an ammo dump went up, and it sounded like the war had started again for about 45 minutes. It sounded like the war was going. This was about April 22nd. So getting your bearings, the church helps. And the other thing that helped is before the war, we and six other agencies decided, not all agencies, but groups who were interested in Iraq, decided that the best thing we could do would be to pick the people that we should help in Iraq regardless of what happened, whether there was war or not war. And those people, I'd like to explain to you with this little graph. We started a campaign called All Our Children. All Our Children. The idea was to meet the critical health needs of the most vulnerable Iraqi children. And there are about 5 million kids in Iraq who qualify. Iraq has 25 million people. 25 million people. Half of them are kids. So 12 and a half million kids. And of those 12 and a half, about 5 are in some kind of trouble. And the reason they are is, you had the first Gulf War here, at the end of a lot of frustration with Saddam Hussein and his regime, obviously. And many of his crimes are in the past and aren't in his graph, you know, and the suffering of his people. You had the second Gulf War here in 2003. And up until 2000, Iraq underwent the steepest rise in infant mortality in the world. Now, if there's one statistic that sort of matters in places where there's big trouble, threats to human life, it's infant mortality. And the figure is, here, they're pretty much like us in 1990. The U.S. has, I think, anybody know exactly? I think it's 15 per thousand kids don't make it to the age of 5. 15 per thousand. Anybody a mathematician? That's about 1 in 70 or 80?
5%, 1 in 5 in 100, 1 in 20.
15 out of 1,000.
15 out of 1,000.
It's 1.5.
1.5.
Okay, Iraq was down near that point. By the time the decade was over, they were up here at 1 in 8. One child in 8 not living to the age of 5. Then the Oil for Food program, where they were selling some oil under the UN, and they were able to do a food basket for each family, made mostly starches, sugars, tea, oil, basic stuff. You don't die on it, but you don't live very well either. They've gotten down to 1 in 10. But so they used to be like us, and here they're like Mauritania, you know, West African country with terrible infrastructure and health statistics. And so we said what we need to do is what we've been doing already during the 90s, but sporadically so, raise this money. We said we're going to raise $1 million for Iraqi kids that need help. To do what? To give them basic medical care, immunizations, treating dysentery. What kills them? Dysentery. Diarrhea, Shigella, cholera. That's what killed them. That's why this figure is so high. Another way to say it, in 1989, this actually is from, 9 Iraqi kids out of 10 had clean water from a pipe, like we have. 9 out of 10 had that. In 2000, only 1 out of 10 had that. So that decade of sanctions took a real high toll on the most vulnerable, the littlest, the youngest, the least powerful Iraqis. And we had done some stuff with them, for them, and with local agencies through the church during the 90s. But, you know, we sort of follow the trade winds, too. If people aren't interested in the place as a humanitarian crisis, we don't get money for it, and money doesn't grow on trees. And so we don't do as much as we would like to do. We tried to pick that up around Christmas time of 2002. We started this All Our Children campaign. And we set the goal of $1 million. We made a website, and we hired a guy to find ways to help those kids. And he worked right up to the war, and then I went back with him about 12 days after the fall of Baghdad. What I'd like to do with you now is go back to the top of that hotel and look at a clock face, all right? And there's actually about twice as many spots that I went to see and report on. I do communication work, so I don't do the actual aid work. I take pictures and I tell stories about it. But at 10:30, we're going to start here at 10:30. Home for the Elderly, and I'll show you this on video now. Home for the Elderly, a mental hospital. Over here, 1 o'clock, Hay El Mahdi, sort of a shanty town suburb of Saddam City in the north of Baghdad. And then 4 o'clock, Haifa Club Camp, the world's newest Palestinian refugee camp. And 5 o'clock, Armenian Orthodox Church. See a few snippets of something different, but also related to this because they're members of the church, Middle East Council of Churches. And then back to 10 o'clock, almost round the clock base, pediatric hospital and leukemia ward. So imagine yourself looking out over Baghdad and saying, here I can get my bearings, there I can get my bearings. And I'm speaking as a Christian, I'm speaking as a humanitarian, I'm speaking as somebody who, the ELCA and the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, have we got enough Lutherans here that makes sense? They have this joint agency, Lutheran World Relief, and here's what we try to do in a crisis. So we'll take the screen back down. I will give you a little tiny commentary. As we see the video. These are just rough cuts. Rough cuts from the camera I was carrying. It's not edited properly, but it gives you a slice of each of those places. Can somebody zap the lights? First up will be that home for the elderly. We had about $500,000 worth of quilts, school kits, and health kits. Health kits meaning personal hygiene. Here's the Iraqi Red Crescent. I'll talk over the battle volume, so you might want to turn it down just a little bit. Just slightly. Yeah. And here's Khalid Sudani from the Iraqi Red Crescent. That's like the Red Cross, but since they're Muslim, they don't say cross, they say crescent. And he's counting out health kits for this old folks home, where it was lightly looted. And here's a Shiite woman who works there, and she's just like your Aunt Mabel. You know, the kind of woman who does all the right things at church or at home. So she goes over to this guy who can't walk, and somebody had given him his quilt and health kit, but he couldn't walk, and he's sitting there on the flagstones. And so she kind of helped him and went back to see him later. And meanwhile, she's leading a blind man back to his room in this home for 130 elderly people. Now, all over Baghdad at that point in the year, and to some extent still today, nobody was being paid. So all the aid we did went to the staff as well as the patients. So here are staff opening their health kits. And they're just personal hygiene items. But if you have these items, you can keep your hands clean. You can brush your teeth. You can take a wash and stay healthy. Next, at 11 o'clock on that clock face was a mental hospital. That was somebody's file. This was 1,100 mental patients in Al Rashad Mental Hospital who all were turned loose into the streets of Baghdad because their hospital was looted. One person was killed, some of the women were raped, and by the time we got there, they were no longer being looted, but their looters had turned into their guards because they had to hire some guards and they turned out to be the same people. And this guy's trying to put the files back in order. Now here, could you turn it up? Sorry. The volume?
Yep.
This is Dr. Sarsan, a psychiatrist at that mental hospital. I'll let him talk.
It's so pity how I write prescription on in this way.
You're writing a subscription?
Yes.
For what?
This is one of my patients. His name is Karim Sahab. He used to live in the hospital, but he is on his free. I mean, he is not forced to stay in the hospital. He came and go according to his will. You can see that opening in the wall now there has been fixed by the ICRC. It was smashed down by an American tank. And we have another opening there in the wall. It was also smashed. So they invade the hospital from the front and the rear. Because there were no other tanks in Baghdad but Americans. Yeah.
Why did they come in here?
Well, I think you should ask them the question. This is a hospital, and I'm sure they know that this is a hospital. This is a civil facility. It's not a military base.
And then the looters came in by the same way?
Yeah, they came just following them. And this was not the story here from the hospital. Wherever the Marines go, the looters were behind them. And they were encouraging them to loot and destroy. I'm responsible for what I'm saying because I have seen it with my own eyes in my near
country. Back to number 1 o'clock. It's Hay al-Makti. This is a shanty town of 30,000 people, never recognized by the regime. We were able to go there now because Saddam wouldn't like you to go there before, not to showcase poverty. On this morning, a home clinic is being opened, one of four that we're supporting in poor, poor neighborhoods. And there are 100 people waiting when the door went up, when the door opened. The local partner in this case is a German NGO with one German guy and a bunch of Iraqi volunteer doctors. The trick is, you got 100 people waiting. Who comes in first? How do you help them? Look at some of these moms and kids. It's just like at Holden, right? All these babies around. But here's Dr. Ahmad, and he's looking through the crowd to pick the kids that need help the most. You talk about the things that make so many of them die. Look what he does. He looks around and gives them about a 2-second exam each, and then picks the most needy ones and asks them to come in. The sound will go up again in a minute. Not yet. So here's a 1.5-year-old Signe Jabbar, and she's got virtually all of the statistics in her little body. She's got dysentery, she's got respiratory infection, she's got everything that is killing so many of the kids. Let's just listen to the audio for a while. It's like being at somebody else's doctor's appointment.
She's suffering from diarrhea and vomiting since 5 days ago. Now presented to us as abdominal cramps and diarrhea and moderate dehydration.
And what will happen to her? What will happen to her?
If the treatment is not, if she didn't receive the treatment, she will suffer from dehydration, and the complication of dehydration is maybe brain damage, maybe renal failure.
How often has she been sick? Has this child been sick before? Can you ask her?
Okay, now we're at 4 o'clock, Haifa Club. You can kill the same thing. This is the world's newest Palestinian refugee camp. Why? About 35,000 Palestinians came to Iraq when Israel was created in 48. They're still there. They received special treatment from Saddam Hussein because, in a sense, they're bargaining chips to keep the Israelis at the table to make some kind of a deal. And when Saddam fell and Baghdad fell, landlords who weren't able to raise the rent for 15 years because Saddam was favoring these people, said, get out, I want to rent it to somebody that I can get more money from. In some cases, their homes were hit by missiles or armaments of some kind, and they were homeless. So we're 125 families on this field, and they're receiving a shipment of basic stuff, bedding, and the school kits again, and the health kits again, to have a life here on the sports field. If we have any Mennonites in the group, those are Mennonite blankets, or quilts for Mennonite parishes. The better wrapped ones that you see are Lutheran quilts. And here we are at the Armenian Orthodox Church. And this is Good Friday, and we came in and they said, welcome to Good Friday, we are celebrating the Armenian Holocaust. Anybody know about the Armenian Holocaust?
The Turks. Yeah.
1915, reputedly 1 million Armenians died at the hands of the Turks in eastern Turkey. They're in pockets all over the Middle East. They've kept an identity very much like the Jewish people, a strong religious, cultural, linguistic link. And let's just listen to a bit of it. Some of the most beautiful liturgy in the world. I think the choir wasn't there that day. This isn't quite as pretty. And finally, at the leukemia pediatrics ward of Mansour Hospital, Khaled Sudani again from the Red Crescent. Let's hear his voice.
Why the patients they are coming here just to sit here? Some of the people, they hope like this, but there is no medicine actually. You see here, they are sitting. This kind of, that they are giving them like drugs or something. It's just, this is to tell them that they have something, but this is not the type of medicine actually what they need.
This is Max Masood Masen. He's 5 years old. And he's just on a drip. There's no leukemia drugs for him. But his parents brought him to the hospital. And he's getting a drip of glycerin or something. And then Basha Hashim.
This is in 3 months.
She should work with the baby.
She's 3 months old. You can turn that. She's 3 months old. Her parents came about 200 kilometers for her, hoping to get leukemia medicine. And that's her aunt, Suhaila, who was taking her turn at her bedside. This is ironic because there were other hospitals where we were where there were 3 patients to a bed. But here you have a semi-empty ward because there's no medicine for leukemia patients at this point. And our connection to it is fresh vegetables. That's the end. We can have the lights again. Our connection to it is that for 30,000 bucks, I think, all our children could feed fresh vegetables and fruit for 39 hospitals for 10 days in the greater Baghdad area. And we're doing it then, and we're doing it again now, because the hospital rations aren't real conducive to getting better in the system as it exists there, broken down. I'll close with 2 thoughts. There's a lot that can be said, and I hope we can get into some of our discussion. But the 2 thoughts are these. I felt like what I was looking at in Baghdad was essentially two of the petitions from the Lord's Prayer. Those would be, give us this day our daily bread and deliver us from evil. Most of the people who weren't in trouble for their life, and remember Luther described daily bread as health, safety, food. That's daily bread. And that bottom 5 million who are at risk, they need to give us this day our daily bread. They've been living on the bottom end of the scale of the government food ration. Remember, I've got a statistic here I didn't say, 60% of the country was dependent wholly on that government food ration from the Oil for Food Program. 15 million people in this broken down, squeezed by sanctions regime of a dictator, and the impasse of the outside world not being able to solve the problem of Iraq and blockading it to punish the government, but actually punishing the people. So that dilemma of sanctions coming up there. But deliver us from evil was applied to all of them. Give us our daily bread applied to 5 million, 10 million, 15 million. But deliver us from evil would apply to all of them because of the chaos, the lawlessness, the fear, that landscape of fear that I talked about. So 2 things to kind of pull together what I've been saying. And then finally, because of the quirk of the church year, I had 2 Easters. Because the Eastern Church has a different calendar than the Western Church. And so I got 2 Palm Sundays, 2 Good Fridays, 2 Easter Sundays. I didn't manage to go to church all the time because I was working some of the time. But that Armenian service was Good Friday, and they threw the genocide into the deal because the previous day was the anniversary of the Armenian genocide. So they just did them both together, Good Friday. How's that? You know, liturgical flexibility. Right. But when I went back and I looked at the Gospels, and I noticed 3 things that happened that meant a lot to me in Iraq and to the work we're trying to do there. In that week of Holy Week, the way we talk about it now, between Palm Sunday and Good Friday, there are 3 pretty poignant stories. One is the story of the widow's mite. And I think this All Our Children campaign is a little bit like the widow's mite. In 7 months that campaign has existed, we've raised $600,000. That is truly a widow's mite. Another parable during that week is the parable of the tenants. They haven't raised a whole lot of money. How many times have you seen this story of those children on your television sets or from your leaders? Haven't raised a whole lot of money, but the good we've been able to do with them qualifies us for, I think, if I don't sound too self-promoting here, the agencies I'm talking about, Church World Service, Mennonite Central Committee, Youth World Relief. It's a little bit like you're dealt a hand, you have a few talents, use them well, and you come back and you report to your Lord what you've done. And then finally, just to do the piece de la résistance, in that same week, the Great Commandment gets shared, you know? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. And what else? love your neighbor as yourself. And what better place to think about that great commandment than in a city like Baghdad, with the kind of people you saw there in those places. Thank you.
That we would extend this particular forum up till 10 o'clock. People are welcome to leave as you need to if you have children waiting for you or something. But we'd like to kind of open up for some questions and conversation. And we also have another time slot tomorrow morning at 10:45 in which some conversation could continue. I know I was looking forward to having Jonathan talk a little bit about the Geneva Accords, which I know very little about, under which the umbrella of humanitarian aid is kind of laid out in terms of the responsibility of the invading country for the citizens of the country that is taken over. So depending on whether we get into that tonight, we may be able to continue that tomorrow. But let's just open up for any questions that you might have for either John or Jonathan, or a comment.
Where do you start when you compare night vision goggles to hospitals with no medicine? I mean, the juxtaposition is so stark. How do you get a handle on what to ask?
One way either of you could advertise on TV a commercial that would get that to say, like, we need help in Iraq, what would you do? Like, if you had, say, a minute, what images would you show and what statistics would you use to raise money?
Well, I'd probably be tempted to, this is late at night, going to be a little bit creative here. I talk about these microbial weapons of mass destruction. The little microorganisms in the untreated water. And we know where they are. And we can easily fix them. You gotta fix the sewage plants, you gotta get water purified again. And that takes care of about half of the dying children. And then they've missed 10 years of immunization. Those people, this wiggly green line here is meant to be, I didn't explain it, but I thought of it as Saddam's innocent victims. And I was thinking more on the political side, because he killed a lot of people, and of course it's politics, and so he was doing the Kurds one year, and you know, the Shiites the next, and all that stuff. Terrible, terrible thing. But who's responsible for these children that have suffered this huge climb in infant mortality? I try to explain that in a minute. You know, your question makes me also think how not everything in the world is properly done in a minute. And I think our inability to perhaps have a little time to dust our eyeballs on some of these things would be the place to start. Not so much what you say, but a commitment to learn and to respond. Because fixing this stuff is not expensive. It is really not expensive to fix basic things that keep people alive. Life is actually remarkably cheap to protect.
I've been thinking while Jonathan's been speaking, the military is in a tough situation at times because many of the folks there are not trained. You know, they're trained to do what they do. They invade the country and take ground and make sure that the people that are with them are protected. And the transfer to humanitarian relief and peacekeeping does not come easily. part of the, we talked about this earlier, part of the training that we get as we get more senior in the military involves when you go into a situation like Iraq, before you start, what is your desired outcome? And when you are in there, as Jonathan was saying, and the other non-governmental organizations come in, how do you work with them? How do you help them do their job? How do you protect them while they're out there in kind of a broken down society? So I guess I would say the people that you know that are there and the families of the people that you know that are deployed into Iraq, help them as much as you can with whatever they need. And also, I would say that the military's got a lot of capability, but groups like Jonathan's need the money that you can give them to work with the military and get the situation better. So I guess I would say contribute to things like the Lutheran World Relief.
There's nothing to contribute. Everything we can contribute, we pay in taxes. There's nothing left in taxes and health care and insurance. There's hardly anything left for us to give to these organizations that we wish we could give money to that, but nothing left.
Well, I was very disturbed when the doctor made that allusion that, I mean, he actually said that the military came in and bombed the hospital, and then the looters were right behind it, and the military was actually, you know, egging them on to do it. So how widespread was that? I mean, this is very so disturbing to me, because all the time when we're asked to support the war, it's because we're going to get rid of Saddam, we're going to get rid of all these bad things, but not necessarily destroy the good things. I mean, where do we draw the line? You know, I'm very upset about that. So how widespread was it, the looting? Did Americans actually had a hand on making the lootings happen?
I think you can put a lot down to the fog, so-called fog of war. I left that in there because I heard it many, many times, and it was actually in the European papers, that tanks would go through the city and the looters would follow them like a pack of dogs. And that there was some communication between some tanks and some looters, some tank commanders and some looters. In this case, I don't think they egged them on to attack the hospital, but the fact that they crashed right through the wall, and then what they actually did was drove out the back. They crashed through the front and drove out the back. Saw it was a hospital and crashed through another wall to get out. And so the local hooligans, or whoever they are, you know, people out for a quick dollar, came in and they took everything down to the wiring in the walls. They took the window frames. I mean, that hospital was an empty shell. And when I was there, it was, say, 7 days after it happened, there were only 300 patients who'd come back. The other 800 patients were loose on the streets of Baghdad. And these are mental patients, you know. The guy you saw interviewing was cool because he checks himself in and out. And he said to me, I'm more afraid now than I was ever during the war, because we could see that the bombing was accurate. You know, in this mix of things we're talking about here, let me say to you as a non-military person who got a high draft number in the Vietnam War and never had to go and fight, okay, the bombing was very accurate as far as we could tell. It was just amazing how the Ministry of Transportation looked like a house of cards collapsed. And right next door, in fact, there's a church, an Armenian church next to one of the ministries. And the ministry got collapsed in both Gulf Wars, but the church stood. It's about 500 years old. So I heard quite a few more stories about interaction between. You can't tell what's true, but the European papers shared them quite widely. And I believe that psychiatrist. He told me more than I showed you. He said, I'm not afraid to say this to your camera. He had, his words had the ring of truth about it, about them. So.
Yeah. Do you have any information why that would have happened?
The collusion, maybe?
What's the incentive?
I think you're conquering the enemy capital. And in this case, it was an accident. They drove through the wall. I mean, they should have known it was a hospital compound if the intelligence was good. But, you know, some commander didn't know that, or maybe nobody knew that. So this was an accident, okay, with serious consequences. The story that was printed in Europe, but didn't get into our papers, was that the tank commanders, when they saw the German embassy, turned around to the looters and said, "Get them." And they drove past the French Cultural Center, and they turned around and they said to the looters, "Get them." Now, why Germany and France? So that was reported by the best newspapers in Europe, and it was told to me by several people when I was there. I'd never heard it here. You got to ask, why is this possibly true? And we didn't hear about it. You know, what is our media telling us? What are they spending their time on? In the run-up to this war, in the war itself, and now in the post-war period. How is our system working for us? Are we getting a good base of information? You know, from what I see with my own eyeballs, I have to ask that question.
What do you see as the relationship or the communication between you as a reporter and our government in terms of useful communication and response to what you know to what you're showing, or do you have any connection in that way?
Yeah. A lot of there are 160 NGOs in something called Interaction. It's a coalition of NGOs, international non-governmental organizations, church, non-church, you know, all kinds of people. The ones you think about, CARE, World Vision, they're all there. And the leaders of that met with the administration many times to say, okay, you're going to go to war. What are you going to do about the country afterwards? And they just didn't get an answer. They didn't get an answer. They didn't get any straight plan. I mean, the war looked brilliant. The post-war period, from very early, looked like it wasn't clear what was going to happen. And that was disturbing.
Even in terms of what you said that has happened in the whole decade of the 90s, was there any response to that? No response?
Well, how could you have learned that? It's been going on for 12 or 13 years. You know, this collapse of a country. And it's not, Saddam and his massacres are something to be. Praise God that that's over, you know. But this isn't massacres. This is, you don't treat the water anymore. You don't vaccinate the kids. And you put 500,000 or million, I'm losing it now. I think 500,000 tons of raw sewage a day into the Tigris River, from which the country lives. That's what was happening right before the war. 500,000 tons a day of raw sewage. So, you know, why don't we know about this?
So, in other words, the government that we have now, or whatever, in this time period, doesn't respond, just doesn't give a response to these points of light that are out there trying to do something worthwhile?
No, they should speak for themselves, but they have the U.S. Agency for International Development, and in Iraq, they picked five big agencies and said, we're going to work with you. And they basically said to the rest of us, we're not going to work with you. We had to get a license for those school kits and quilts to go in, and it takes months and months and months of red tape to get a license to ship, you know, toothpaste to Iraq and soap. When you got there, it was a bit of a strange atmosphere. I went to one of the coordination meetings with the occupation authority in one of Saddam's palaces, and four of Jim's C-17s could have sat in that room where we met. It was a hall of state for banquets with a ceiling high enough for your tail. And you literally could, you might have cut the wings off a little bit, but you could have four of them sat. And there was gargantuan French Louis XIV type furniture arranged in little clusters, I guess, where the invited guests would gather for conversation. You know. And we wended our way through these. And then there was a room divider, and down one end, which was walled off to make it small enough to meet in, because there are only 100 people to meet. Still the size of three basketball courts, basically. There were this room full of people in uniform, and then 12 or 15 little NGO people like me coming in to meet. And, you know, I have never in my life gone to a humanitarian meeting with 86 armed men. They all had their M16s, and like Jim and I were talking, I you know, talked to people there in Baghdad, the soldiers guarding our hotel, people at meetings in Washington. And the military is making an incredible effort to train, I think, middle-level officers in civil affairs, humanitarian affairs, concern for community development. One guy is serving in the Philippines. Had a great talk with him about that. So they're doing a lot. They're doing a lot. But I think that this is the issue that, you know, Diane mentioned, and it's sort of a different session or another session, an additional session. Is what's the appropriate role for which people in such a crisis? And we're in a phase now as our country where our government basically thinks it can do it all. And the NGOs can work for it if they want to. And we as American NGOs have a dilemma there, because we're Americans, we're proud of our country, but we know that humanitarian aid needs to be independent. It can't be have a double agenda, whether that be religious or... Remember the groups that wanted to go in and convert people real quick after the war? Franklin Graham and Samaritan's Purse and so on, you know? And then he sort of backed off. That's a double agenda. You want to help them or not, you know? Same thing with the military and the government. You want to help them or what? Or, you know, reshape the country. It's better to have different people doing that, you know? And I think on that, they're not very communicative, because they have a real sense of power. And we can do it all. This idea of sort of a Pax Americana, you know? There's a very palpable sense of that. And that humanitarian aid gets subsumed underneath that. And Colin Powell called it a force multiplier. He called humanitarian aid a force multiplier. Force and humanitarian? I mean, should those words be in the same sentence? I don't think so. I think it's very distinct. I looked around. I was happy, actually, in Baghdad to be sleeping bag razor wire with GIs out front. And you had to go past and they checked your passport, you know? Because there was a lot of shooting at night. And so that's like the police role, you know, guarantee public order. I'm not a soldier, I'm not a policeman. I believe in soldiers and policemen for public order and some kind of rough justice like that. But that's a long way from what you need to do to do good humanitarian work. And let me tell you, I could go on and on, but those Dr. Ahmed, the guy that examined the little baby, he's a regular doctor. And he finishes his shift at noon or 1 o'clock, and then he comes and volunteers for this NGO. And all the other doctors were like him, doing that. And so you've got a growth in Iraqi society of people trying to fix things. And I think that's worth $1 billion to see that kind of initiative at the local level. And so we picked that NGO to work with them because they showed that respect for the local structures. And their boss said something to me that really rang true in that setting where, you know what the occupation is costing us? $3.9 billion a month. You know what that works out at? $1 million every 10 minutes. And this German guy said to me, he'd been there 5 years, working out of the back of a house. He said, we're working where there's no money to be made. And I thought that was really valuable, because you can go to Washington as an NGO and put out a big proposal. I know a group who's getting, they have to spend $1 million a month on Iraqi civil society of Uncle Sam's money. Sort of dump money on it and fix the problems. That's not going to work. You've got to work patiently. Like I said before, community development, real relief even, relief that will actually last and not just be a band-aid, requires investment in people. An organization, a civil society. It doesn't require billions and billions of dollars. You can do a lot with it. So, what did you ask? That was my answer. Sorry.
I had a question on, you said you had to have licensure to take in the help aid there. What were the five agencies that were allowed by the USA.
Which ones?
Yeah, what? Who were they?
We at LWR, we take a vow of not criticizing other agencies, so come and see me privately. No, there are five good, big, good agencies, but they chose to kind of work, in a sense, they should have been at that meeting in the palace, but the occupation governors weren't happy with just those five. They wanted the rest of us to come and work for them too. And I was in an NGO meeting, and there's a huge debate from the European aid workers there saying, we're not going to any meeting with the Pentagon. Just refuse. French, German, just refuse. And some of us said, listen, under the Geneva Convention, and here's where you can talk about the legalities of it, the occupying power is in charge of that country. The Geneva Conventions and international humanitarian law that's part of it. We're really pragmatic. They say, if you conquer a country, fine. Doesn't say it's right, but you can do it if you want to. Then you're responsible. So, you know, we've heard a bit about this, how a guy from NPR told me, Scott Simon, for Saturday morning, we worked with him a little bit, and he said he thought the war was worth it because all these innocent victims, political victims, were stopped. So any lives lost in the war were valuable, were worth it in order to put an end to this. But since we're the occupying power, we're now in charge. So Saddam's problems are now our problems. And Saddam's unaddressed problem is these little babies who don't live long enough. Now that's our problem, because we're in charge. And the Geneva Convention goes on to say that you can do it if you want to, Mr. Occupying Power. But what you really have to do is see that it gets done. And so you have this discretionary choice about who should do it, you know? Somebody whose specialty it is, somebody who is wearing civilian clothes, somebody who's wearing a uniform, somebody who's armed, somebody who's not armed. You've got to decide who's most appropriate. And those lines have been pretty blurred lately, more so than ever. But that's a whole sweep of sort of recent history. Yeah.
Jonathan, maybe both of you could comment. When we talked earlier today, it seemed like your question in the back had a little bit to do with, given that there are both NGOs and military presence in this area with plenty of work and suffering, how do they communicate with each other? In a constructive way, and you talked about that a little bit earlier today in terms of sort of what both need around both, you know, the NGOs needs of safety, you know, military needing expertise. So could you both comment a little bit about, you know, what are some of the steps that you think are or need to happen about that?
As Jonathan mentioned, and I think of it too, as you get part of your training in the military, as you become more senior, is the fact that you're in a situation, you've got to have an idea what you're going to do at the end, and you're not going to be able to do all the things Jonathan's saying, need doing, that the non-governmental organizations are a vital part of the post-conflict, for lack of a better word. The problem comes now is, imagine, you say, what, there's 25 million people in the country. You know, New York and kind of the surrounding area, there's maybe that many people, or in LA. You know, imagine every single person in one of those cities has a gun, and as opposed to the 90% of the people that basically feel that we need to obey the law and we need to do the appropriate things, now it's the police force in either LA or New York against every single citizen, and 90% of the citizens that are being law-abiding have now decided that they're going to get what's come to them because the last 10 or 12 years they've been repressed by this awful regime. And you can, maybe that will help you get an idea of the magnitude of the problem that the military is facing right now. And before I say anything more, I'm a flyer in a strategic airlift unit. I'm not a policy guy in the military. I haven't been involved in any of the discussions. My experience in Iraq has been 45 minutes at the airport with the engines running, waiting to get back in the airplane. So really anything I say is kind of a personal observation on my part. It's not an official representation of military policy. But part of the problem too is that Jonathan and his people have to be protected when they're there. So to go out and try to distribute the aid, and say 40 people go out in an aid convoy, and 1,000 or 1,500 or 2,000 starving.